A lotus flower has long roots originating in mud. They reach up and up to the surface of the water where a truly remarkable flower blooms and floats elegantly atop a peaceful glassy surface. Have you heard the Thich Nhat Hanh saying, no mud, no lotus? Signifying that without suffering through the mud, you cannot find the happiness of the lotus. We all experience varied levels of deep suffering. It's a part of life. However, it's what we do with this that makes the difference. Do we stay wedged in victim consciousness, or do we alchemize this mud to be our greatest gift and offering to the world? In my conversation today with Ali Awad, the CEO lawyer, we explore the concept of controlled hardship and how children greatly benefit from it. He shares how we can alchemize perceived struggle to wield a gift that is influential for our immediate family, local community, and society at large. He shares the deep spiritual and practical value of delayed gratification, and one of my favorites, how one of his multi-million-dollar settlements in court pierced a hole in the pharmaceutical industry's poisonous business model. And just before I jump in, hit that subscribe button for more conversations with thought leaders and experts dedicated to reclaiming self-sovereignty, health, and freedom. Ali, thank you so much for being here. I know we've tried to make this happen a few times, so I am very excited, very grateful, feeling blessed to have some of your time and to be able to share this space to have this conversation.
I'm really glad that we finally were able to connect. It's going to be fun.
There's so much I wanted to talk to you about, and I figured that I would start with what I feel like is in the zeitgeist right now, which is initiations. Because as I listened to you in different interviews and was looking at your content and, you know, feeling really inspired and connected, I was like hearing your story, you know, about growing up in the US. And I know this is something you've expounded on quite a bit, that kind of inner fire of providership and creativity and entrepreneurship. And that's something that I see a lot of young boys don't have. And they're not really accessing that because maybe they don't have a father figure. Maybe they don't see the purpose of it. There's something missing in this generation when it comes to that inner fire. And so could you talk a little bit about your story, share your experience coming up in that sense? And maybe we can kind of go into like why that's lacking now.
My gut instinct is godlessness. I think primarily there's lack of faith and lack of religious following. And it doesn't matter which religion it is. There should be some sort of moral guide, moral compass that tells you, hey, here's what's right, here's what's wrong. Even if you think this is good for you, it's actually not good for you. One of my favorite ayat in the Quran is don't love that thing which might actually be bad for you, and don't love that and don't hate the thing that could actually be good for you. So, you know, when you're talking about little kids, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, alhamdulillah. You got to teach them everything, blank slate, from start to finish. And I don't want to make the comparison of like my children with the team members that I have in the firm, but like a brand new fresh employee that knows nothing about our company, you kind of have to teach them everything you possibly can in a short amount of time to get them up to speed. And the longer you work with people, the more you realize there's gaps in their knowledge. And the gap in their knowledge could be due to their literal education, their formal education, their upbringing, their society. But the fundamental issue that I see is lack of faith and godlessness in the household. And so I think that's where it starts. I think the dad, the father figure, has to see himself as a leader for his children, and that you're going to be leading by example. And so for me, this was going to the mosque every day, usually twice a day for about 15 years in a row. I don't think we missed any prayers at the mosque between morning prayers and night prayers. This meant learning how to read Quran, learn Tajweed, learn Arabic at a young age, lead the prayer at age 7, 8, 9, regularly, be a leader in the community. Get used to excelling at everything that you do, because that's the standard. So the faith is a really big part of it, but faith doesn't create ambition, especially like financial success and financial ambition. It's almost unrelated. Unless you believe that God gave you a specific skill that you must take advantage of, because in taking advantage of that skill, you can help a lot of people. And that's what I believe. I believe that everyone has certain skills and attributes that God gave you. And your purpose, your goal, is to maximize those skills for the benefit of society and the benefit of your community. So the reason I have these skills, number one, is because of God. Number two was also my parents and my societal upbringing. So I think some people have the innate ability because God gave them that skill, but then they do nothing with it. And I think that's the bigger problem in our society. I think people have the fundamental skills. They don't want to necessarily do anything with it. There's a lack of ambition. And so this also can become a generational problem. You know, famous quote that says, tough times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. Weak men create bad times. Bad times create strong men. And it just kind of goes into that cycle. And your goal is to just keep strong men, you know? Yeah, I know I went off tangent a little bit, but to answer your question, I think it's because lack of faith and then lack of the father figure and the mother figure knowing their roles in raising their children. And if you're more career focused as an adult and you just let your kids be raised by YouTube, don't expect to have a relationship with them when they're teenagers and adults.
Absolutely. And I see this often with boys in our current generation, right? Because if both of the parents are working, the kids are in daycare or they're on a device, you know, they're typically around women in daycare or in preschool or in schooling of any kind. It's mostly female teachers. So where are the boys getting the male initiation if not going to the masjid or going to their place of worship or with their father? So they're around a lot of women and they're not, you know, being nurtured. They're being nurtured by women, but the instinct, the more masculine qualities are not being nurtured by male figures. And boys are also not in multi-generational situations, right? They're in maybe second grade and they're only with boys who are age 7. They're supposed to be, right, with, you know, historically in the tribal setting, they were watching older boys and young men and older men and then the elderly do different things in society and in that, you know, amoeba, an organism, in order to survive and to be successful. And so now when they're in this kind of mono age group and they're learning things from YouTube, you know, where are they getting that initiation? I know that story. I mean, some of the story of you, you know, starting your online business at a young age, right? And feeling that drive. And perhaps it was because, you know, you had siblings, you had your father, there were men in your community. I'm not sure exactly where that was derived from. But it was this desire to survive and adapt. And I think now, you know, it's like a slippery slope, right? Because we want life to be easier for our children. We want them to feel, you know, safe and supported and nurtured. But we also maybe are doing it too much in the sense that they're not being, you know, they're not being polished. You know, that rough diamond's not being polished. They're not having to face adversity. So what do we do?
You have to create controlled environments of hardship for your children. And you have to make them earn the things that they want. And the reason I think that I'm ambitious financially is because I wasn't competing, you know, at a societal level. I was competing at a familial level. Being the third child out of 6, you're kind of, you know, the middle child that's forgotten. And so I desperately wanted the attention and the fulfillment and the approval of my father. That was a big driving factor for me. And my father, who dedicated his life after his father passed away to taking care of his immediate family, because he's the oldest male in his entire family of 10, 11 siblings, all of them became his responsibility, because it's just kind of a cultural thing where the oldest male, you know, becomes the father of the house. In addition to him getting married, starting his own family. So he's kind of the grandfather of the entire Awad family. And so you're not just competing to get the attention between your five siblings. You're competing to get the attention of your 100+ cousins. So here's how it worked. My dad knew that if he's spending his time with us and raising us, then we don't need anything. We just need him and that's it. You don't need any money. You don't need any resources. You don't need anything. As long as you're with dad, you're fine. Okay. Everyone else doesn't have your same dad. So all the money that we make as a family needs to go to the rest of the family because they need the help and they need the support. And if you do that for 10, 15 years in a row, and you lift your head out of the sand for just a few minutes, you realize I've had this seven-figure work ethic for years and this competitive nature for years. And now I get to go to law school and become a licensed attorney and I send one letter and make $1 million on this letter when I used to hustle plugging tires for $5 on 1804 Murray Avenue in Dalton, Georgia when I was 9 years old, when I had used tires exploding in my face working in the mechanic shop. So you're telling me like, this is the hard part? No, I've already been through the hard part. And I would say this, the youth of this generation should be most fearful and most concerned with the upcoming generation of refugees. Just like, and I'm going to make an analogy here that some people are not going to like, but it's true because I've seen it. A lot of African Americans that have been here for multiple generations don't like first generation Africans. The hunger level is very different. And if you want to really go like specific, look at the Nigerian immigrants that come here, first generation Nigerian immigrants. This is not religious or anything because they all have different religions, but the level of business acumen and ambition that they have compared to their colleagues of similar ages is starkly different. And I think it goes to the fundamental concept in America that once your kid turns 18, then they're an adult, you kick them out of the house. And there's this delay of adolescence. There's a delay of adulthood. When for us, I think by the time your kids turn 7, in previous times, previous generations, a 7-10-year-old could lead an army. They're not sitting at home playing video games all the time and waiting till they're 18 years old living in their, you know, mom's basement, right? So I think delaying adulthood is a huge problem. And now you're seeing with Gaza and with Syria and with Lebanon, the adulthood has been accelerated. So you have 5, 6, 7-year-olds that are the head of household. And so because we have the luxury of being able to delay adulthood and adolescence for our children and the aggressive diversity and adversity that they can have, it becomes incumbent upon us to create hardship for them sooner, because at least you can do it in a controlled environment. Can't say, okay, I'm just going to send my kid to Palestine, see how they survive for the next few years. They don't have that luxury. They don't have that option, but we can create hardship for them so that at the very least, they understand that, hey, when you click a switch and the light turns on, you should be thankful for that. When every morning you wake up and the water is warm, you should be thankful for that. And the only way they can understand it is if they see and experience the opposite. And so for me, by the time my kids turn 7, I am going to be putting them in manual labor jobs, 100%. My kids will be working manual labor, whether that's in a farm or washing cars or anything that requires their bare hands to work, construction, anything. That's the one thing that we have that I've seen a lot of people don't have. You didn't work with your bare hands, so you don't appreciate how awesome it is to work with your mind. And so I think that's the process that needs to happen for children. And because I looked up to my dad so much as a kid, I think the other problem is boys in this generation don't really look up to their dads as much. Probably because they never had proper upbringing, or they never had a sense of what a successful parent looks like, because it's a generational problem. My dad was forced to be the leader of the household. If his dad was alive and stayed alive, who knows how it would have happened? Remember, asa an takrahu shay'an wa khayrun lakum. Don't hate the thing that could be good for you. You know? So yeah, I think it's, we get the luxury of talking about this, in the comfort of our own homes, with AC or heat, with our kids fully fed, everyone is fine, right? But you don't want to have that kid become an adult without going through hardship. And at least I can control your hardship now. And I can make you earn the things that you want now. And I think that's easier said than done. We'll see in a couple of years. I might be a big fluffy, big softy, you know, and I don't do anything. Who knows?
Well, that's the thing. It's removing the idea that it's somehow creating suffering for them, you know, undue suffering, because it's not. We're actually doing a disservice to our children because we're teaching them to be consumers. And then once they have to be out in the world surviving, they just don't have the skills. And that's a huge disservice to our children. So that controlled hardship you're talking about is, it's brilliant because we never lived, I mean, historically, cross-culturally, since the beginning of time, right? Little girls were learning the crafts of home, right? They weren't staying, you know, waking up and watching Paw Patrol first thing in the morning. They were helping their mother, you know, carry water, collect firewood, cook, make sure that everybody was fed, clean the house, you know, and by a certain age, maybe 7 or 8 was when the boys would deviate from the nurturing of the mother and start working with the father on how to do the male things, you know, in their role in society and in the tribe and in the family.
That's exactly how it was for us. I mean, I can tell you definitively when I was 8 years old, and my younger brother, Sam, is just 11 months younger than me. When I was 8 years old, my two older brothers and I convinced my dad to let us open the mechanic shop on Sundays so that we could make a little bit of extra money for us to save and be able to spend on things. Because we had a budget, if you want, for school supplies and for school clothes. It's like, hey, I'm going to spend $50 on you, figure out how to make it work at Walmart. And honestly, what we usually did was we just took the money and saved it and be like, hey, I'm fine with these tattered jeans for the year. Even though my dad would never let us go out with crappy clothes. That's just how we thought. And he started noticing it. So whatever money we didn't spend, we would, you know, he would take it back. But I remember being 8 years old, convincing my dad to let me work in the mechanic shop on Sundays so we could split the money. And it lasted a total of 3 Sundays before my dad made it a requirement that the shop is open on Sundays, 7 days a week, and he keeps all the money. And so, like, those things were innate. But I was also, my younger brother Sam was also too young to go at that time. He was still in the nurturing phase. Just like you were saying, around 7 or 8, the boys kind of break off. So I remember the exact moment when that happened. I was 8 and he was 7. And then, within a year, he went into the mechanic shop and then he started selling cars when he was 9 years old. And we started selling electronics at 11, 12. This was just, it's how it was because we would drive my mom crazy if we stayed at home. So might as well go to the mechanic shop.
Biologically, that's when mammals tend to deviate for the most part. You know, apes, humans at age 7 is when they start to deviate from the mother. It's just the way, boys and girls, it's just the way that we are. And so this is why, you know, the mother being at home and feeling supported in her role to be at home is so essential for the survival of the nuclear family and the health of the nuclear family. And then that's, you know, as a childbirth educator, this is what I tell my clients and my students, like, we have to create an opportunity for women to be able to do this if we want the nuclear family to survive, for the health of the whole family and for the healthy and secure attachment of the children. And then they go out and learn the skills that they need to. And boys should not be at home, you know. They have so much energy. They need to channel that somewhere. That's why when I laugh when my friends say, oh, you know, my son can't sit in circle time. I'm like, of course he can't. And he shouldn't. Like, he's 5. He needs to, like, run around, climb trees, do all the things. You know, girls can sit around and sew more easily. We're just wired differently. And so it's also an acknowledgement of the two genders that have very clear different needs, you know, and skill sets. So I think the lack of acknowledgement there is also part of the challenge, let's say, for this generation.
You alluded a little bit to gender roles. And I want to talk about that a little bit. Because both culturally and religiously, for me, it's the man's responsibility to take care of his wife and the family, right? Financially. It's cultural and religious.
It's also biologically how we're wired.
Yeah, right.
We just deny it.
Okay. So let me flesh this out without trying to sound offensive. Girls and women of this generation, especially in the Middle Eastern culture, don't want to rely on men to be their providers. And it comes in the form of wanting to pursue education, which I agree with. I agree that especially when you either can't rely on the man or there's a risk of the man not living, you know, very long life, the woman should have skills. The mom should have enough skills, enough talent, enough resources, enough knowledge to be able to take care of the family, obviously in an extreme situation, right? But that shouldn't be the goal from day one, that I never want to have a man to be part of the family, because the father also has his responsibilities in the home. But I think especially in Middle Eastern cultures, there's a generational gap with how Middle Eastern and Indo-Pak men treat their wives and their children. And so they're kind of detached from the raising of their children. I don't know if my dad ever changed a diaper. You know, I've changed thousands. I don't know if my grandfather was around with the babies. They usually were traveling and going and doing business for 6 months in another country. Like, they weren't really involved with the household upbringing of the children. You know how they say it takes a village, right? But that's also because in previous generations, the village was helping the family. Like, you'd have your sisters and your sisters-in-law and everyone would be close by. And so if you could drop off your kids for a little bit so you can go do your thing, it's possible. Well, we don't have that sense of familiarity and like that community now. And so it puts so much more pressure and stress on the moms in our community, because the dad has to not only be able to provide financially, they also have to be able to help in the household. That's kind of how our generation works now, because the mom doesn't have the ability to just sit there and watch. And they're comparing too. They're on social media. They're comparing to other people's unrealistic lifestyles. And so are the men. They're looking at all the Lambos and Ferraris and thinking, man, why am I not in a private jet? You know? And your wife is sitting there thinking, why do I not have the, you know, all these Hermes and these Birkins and these Chanel bags? Why do I not have these yet? You know, what's this guy out doing and working? Meanwhile, the kids are raised on YouTube. And so I think it's important that we understand, first, the men need to step it up. They need to get in the workforce. They need to have hard skills. They need to understand that financial success is important from a biological perspective for women too, but that's not the only thing that they can bring to the table. Because if all you can bring to the table is financial success, you're going to attract that type of person. But that needs to just be a prerequisite to building a family. Like, the financial awareness and business acumen and knowledge, salesmanship, that's a prerequisite to getting to the table to talk about, okay, well, let me start a family. Let me have a relationship. And similarly for the women, I think it's a good idea to have a prerequisite of a high level of knowledge and skill. The home activities, I think, are important for your daughters to learn. I think it's important even for your young boys to learn how to do the dishes and do the chores, right? And we did that as young boys. But when we got older, we worked in a mechanic shop. And my sister wasn't changing tires. So those roles are important. And I think we're coming to a point in society where it's socially unacceptable to talk about specific gender roles. And I'm like, look, dude, I'm not trying to hurt anyone's feelings, but this is how I like my household to operate. And if you want a similar household, then maybe abide by these principles. But don't come complaining to me saying, hey, I don't know what's going on with my finances or with my family or with my kids. Hey, I can't have a relationship with my kid. Well, do you know who his pediatrician is? Let's start there. Like, do you know if he has any allergies? You know, so it's different, and it's hard. It's a lot harder now for men to be successful.
There's a lot of pressure on men. I mean, there is a lot of pressure on men, like you said, because historically we lived in communities where women were being supported. We were not meant to raise children alone in this little pod, which is our home, separated from other people. I mean, half of us don't even know our neighbors, right? And so women have a lot of pressure and they become resentful, as if it's the man's role to fill all the roles of what she needs. And that's not realistic either, right? He cannot be your whole village. And so there's unrealistic expectations that are set on each person. And then there's also this recoiling from responsibility, because sometimes it feels like too much, you know. And I think, you know, what you said is so spot on. There's so much influence from social media and the internet, right? It's like the internet is an incredible tool, right, for better or worse. And it's the discernment that we need to be able to navigate it and not be so influenced by it. We need that inner, that soft heart, strong spine, where we're open and available to learn and we're humble, but we also have the really strong discernment. And I think a lot of men have just not mastered that, right? And they've not been able to seek out their purpose. It sounds like you were given opportunities to really carve out your purpose from a young age. So when you got to, law school and this kind of higher level of education, you were like, oh, I got this because I already went through this more controlled hardship and I was already asked to make difficult decisions. And I think that's a big thing for young boys is where are they being called to make difficult decisions? Where are they being taught discernment? And that kind of brings me into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, because as consumers, right, we're a society at this point that is so trained to consume. And I think this is a big part of why we are so depressed as a society is because we're not creating enough. We're not doing enough with our hands. We're not creating enough. We're not seeing the fruits of our labor manifest in front of us. We're not, and without that, we're just consuming, that's not anywhere we want to be. It's very depressing. And so, how do we build that discernment as consumers of information? And this is big because, we've seen this going on for over a year now, where there is a lot of information about what's happening in Gaza. And we are, I have my own perspective and I have my own capacity to discern. I've been for the last 6 years, dismantling the way the medical system has been reshaping the female birthing experience, the family's birthing experience, and a lot of the lies and manipulation and control that happen when women become pregnant, even in the fertility industry. That's
so, side point to that. And I don't know if this is a standard number, but the hospital here in Atlanta, what percentage of births do you think are natural versus C-section?
Like the overall C-section rate in the hospital, I'd say probably is like 45%. That's my guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a third. I was blown away by that number. There's no way. There's no way that, like, absent so many diet problems, so much forcing you with bad information, there's no reason why two generations ago we were like under 1% and now we're at 33%. It's also interesting that two generations ago, less than 1% of kids identified as LGBTQ and now it's over 21%. And so there's almost like this indoctrination of information that's shoved down people's throats. And like I said from the very beginning, all of it stems from godlessness and from lack of faith. When anytime you put money over very simple morals, that's a problem. And I think just we don't talk about that enough because it might hurt someone's feelings or it's not inclusive enough. Man, get that shit away from me. I don't like it. I don't want it. And I'm going to build myself to a financial level to where if I want to change it, I will change it. I'm sorry. That was just something I wanted to bring up. Like the fact that because they can bill you for another day. They also limit the population growth by doing that because you can only have so many C-sections. It's dangerous for the mom. They're usually going to be on some sort of medication afterwards. It's like turning you into a customer. That's what the healthcare system has become, is just how can we get a higher LTV? That's my problem with the medical and the insurance world anyway, at least for personal injury lawyers. The only way that I'm successful is if insurance companies keep taking advantage of you. That's the only
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely.
So it's like they hate us, call us ambulance chasers and try to drag us through the mud because we're the only ones holding these huge corporations accountable. And so I'm sure you have a lot of opinions on the birthing process and the information there, but that blew my mind. That blew my mind when I found out.
Well, yeah, I mean, we made the switch to hospital birth in 1890s. It was only about handful of women who could afford it because it was sold and marketed as a very nice, luxurious experience. You didn't have to be at home dealing with the mess. You could be given twilight sleep and then you could just wake up and have your baby. And you didn't even have to do anything with your baby for a few days because there would be nurses feeding it formula. So this is where the pharmaceutical industry and formula companies were able to make their entrance into the one of the most lucrative human occurrences, right? Women are giving birth every day, everywhere in the world. Those numbers are declining, and that's another conversation. However, this is where they made their entry point. And by 1950, probably 60% of women in the US were birthing in hospitals. So it only took 50 years of really good marketing. And at that point, they were starting to say, you know, it's dangerous to birth outside of the hospital. So they used fear as a tactic to get people to further support hospital birth. We put something that's completely natural, right, divinely designed, into a hospital rhetoric, into a framework that is for emergency care. And so now we've completely conflated two things that are actually unrelated. The amount of women who are actually high risk requiring emergent care in a hospital when it comes to their birth, those numbers are so low compared to what the actual C-section rate is today.
Oh, 100% agreed, 100%.
So when people say birth is dangerous, look at the C-section rates. I say, no, it's the decisions and lack of education and fear-based education that's given through media and all these channels and social media that compel women to do things and make decisions from this fear-based, uninformed place that then lead them into C-sections. It's a cascade effect. And like, I know you're familiar with this because all you have to tell a woman is, oh, you're 35, you're geriatric, your pregnancy is geriatric, so we need to monitor you more. We should actually induce you because there's a higher risk of birthing after 40 weeks if you're 36 years old. And so then the woman's convinced to do an induction. Induction doesn't go well because it's, you know, a medication or a drug that affects the heart. Baby doesn't respond well. So she gets a epidural. She can't deal with the pain. She gets magnesium sulfate to lower her blood pressure. Now baby's really sleepy. Its heart doesn't respond well. Again, goes into a C-section. And now the baby's in NICU for 2 weeks. So every day the tab is growing and insurance companies are having a field day, right? And women are coming out traumatized, not wanting to birth anymore. Men are like, whoa, I don't even know how to connect with my wife and my family after this horrific experience. So it has a ripple effect in so many dimensions we are not even aware of. So this is part of what I'm getting to is like, how do we become discerning consumers? Because even watching a lot of the, you know, political things happening on the news right now, who is it benefiting?
Mostly Zionists. It's mostly the people that are at the top of these companies. So I was involved with Infamil and a couple of other baby formula litigation cases. And I didn't pay attention to it until 2021 when my first kid was born. And the moment that you have the baby, they immediately bring in these bottles, these formula bottles. And you know what the first ingredient was?
Soybean oil?
High fructose corn syrup. That's the first ingredient. And the very first thing that a baby tastes in America is high fructose corn syrup. Now, usually people are not going to mind as long as the baby is fed and they're sleeping, like, fine, whatever. What happens when your baby suffers from necrotizing enterocolitis, where their insides start burning because they're not designed to be able to take this baby formula, especially an artificial substance like high fructose corn syrup? Well, now you're dealing with the most excruciating torture and pain of this baby. And only when you can file a lawsuit and force this company into a massive financial downfall will they change their processes. So when there's a group of people that worship money more than anything else, you have to hurt them financially in order to make a change. And that involves you having the financial wherewithal yourself, you having access or influence in the media and the news, and you being able to control your household. Whatever your kids see, whatever your family sees, these are things that are 100% in your control. And you get to choose what information you want to give them. You can decide to be in the bubble of indoctrination, just like I'm sure you feel every single day with women trying to decide where they want to have their baby. And my perspective is very similar in that I see the incredibly painful the lawsuits and the suffering that moms go through by watching their kids basically burn from the inside out because of because a baby formula company wanted to make more money. And because they lied on the cover of the baby formula indicating that it's mother's milk or just like mom's milk when it's really not. It's just an artificial substance. And so, yeah, I think it's important for you to be involved in work that you feel makes the world better, right? And it's even better if you can figure out how to be profitable at that. You know? So I think a lot of people that have these like good hearts, you seem like a good-hearted person, they end up in businesses that don't make money. And so like you need both. You need the financial power and you need the influence. It's not enough that the smart people are just helping society. Some of those smart people need to know how to make a lot of money to change the way that society functions.
Yeah, at a policy level, for sure.
That's the faster way to do it. You know, side note, you know what the entire lobbying budget for the NRA is? National Rifle Association. I'm thinking this is a big organization. They are spending billions. They got to be spending billions, right? $20 million.
Oh, wow.
That's the entire lobbying budget for the NRA. And we have more school shootings in America than any other country. So there's clearly a direct correlation between the access and the ability to buy weapons and firearms with the amount of kids that end up getting shot up in schools and public places. So clearly, for $20 million, you can buy the morals and the ethics in America. And the crazy thing is, there's not enough good people that have access to that $20 million. That's why it's important for some of the best and brightest minds that have good, clean hearts. They really need to be focused on the financial aspect of it. And that leads me to, if you have a company that has influence and power, you should never sell it to a private equity company that's Zionist controlled. Because they're just going to take your company, kill the brand, extract all the resources, and put it into their machine. And I think, you were asking this question of like how do we change it from a societal level? I think it has to start with you. Like, you have to personally only want to work with like-minded people. You have to consciously stop spending your money with companies, organizations, and people that don't give a shit about you. You have to spend some time educating the public and showing them like, hey, there's a better way to do this. And the unfortunate thing is that the public is very critical and they have to see that you're successful before they believe in you. In Arabic, they have a saying, "Innas bas bawaqfu ma'al khayt al-wa'if," which means people only stand with a wall that's already been built. So I can't rely on you if you're in the process of just building your wall. I can't lean on you. I can't rely on you. But then what happens is once you've built that wall and you have the resources and you have the power, now you're like, dude, I don't want to deal with anyone. I'd rather just stay hidden. I'll throw a couple of donations here and there and that's it. Because you've earned privacy. You've earned financial power at that point, right? The hard part is when you're public, you can't choose to go private. But when you're private, you can choose to go public. You know what I mean? And so if you want the attention of the youth, you have to grab their attention. You have to be attractive to them. The youth want to see successful leaders that they can align with. It doesn't matter if you run a billion-dollar company, you drive a Toyota Camry. Your son doesn't care. You know, you pull up in a Lambo and your kid gets to see the lifestyle that you get and with how you're influencing the community and giving donations and being a strong philanthropist, and everywhere you go, people respect you. That's what you want your kid to see. So that's how we change it. We have to be the ones. Like, I'm consciously aware of where I spend my money and who I do business with. And I think we can do that from a societal level. I know that went off tangent a little bit, but that's where my mind goes, is chase the money. You want to know if things are wrong? See where the money flows. That's where you're going to find most of your problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting because so many of us unknowingly have money trauma. I learned about money trauma maybe 7 years ago. It's a real thing. I worked with this incredible woman, Amanda Francis, and I took her course and did some of her one-on-one stuff. And it was life-changing to see the stories that we tell ourselves, right? The phrases that we tell ourselves. One example is, she said, write down the 10 things that you learned about money growing up. right? And one of the phrases I remember writing, I was like, money doesn't grow on trees. I heard that a lot. And then I remember she's like, yeah, it does. It's made of paper, right? And I was like, oh. And she's like, what else? What else you got? You know, and I was like, everything I said, she just flipped it on me and was like, this is a story. You choose to live in this scarcity. You choose to stay within this really small world. And no matter the skill set you have, no matter the drive you have, if you have these beliefs, it's never going to change. And I remember she said, you know, she's like, I grew up in a trailer park in Oklahoma. I would see, you know, girls in their Toyota 4Runners and, you know, their long blonde ponytails shopping at Macy's. And I hated them. She's like, I hated them because they had everything. And I just kept saying, you know, money is evil. They're evil, right? Wealth is the root of all evil. It causes suffering. It causes wars. And she's like, when I changed that, when I started to see money as a tool, money as a currency for getting more things, for doing good in the world, for creating opportunities for other people, she's like, everything changed for me. And so, you know, in learning from her and understanding that we all have money trauma, meaning these phrases we tell ourselves that keep us small, I was able to take, right, what I had been doing, serving my community in the birth world, working as a guardian at Lightum, managing foster care cases. I was able to change those things and actually reach more people because of the wealth that was generated. And my goal was to reach more women, to say, you have options, you have choices, right? And so would you say that in your work, because you mentor people, you coach people, you have employees, you've said things like, their success and their wealth is my success and my wealth, you know, and that's just not, you know, it's not a mentality that a lot of people have. Would you say that changing our belief system and our relationship to money will create more abundance?
Absolutely. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of money out there. It's literally printed out of thin air. And now it's digital. You just got to figure out a way to get some of it. And a lot of times that just starts with a mindset shift that money is very abundant and I can attract money if I become attractive to it. And so there are business people that get to a certain level where it's impossible for them to lose money. Because they've sharpened the sword so many times, they can identify a no-brainer deal and a good financial transaction. And then they get to a point where it's like, okay, I'm just going to wait for the deals to come to me because I've reached that level of financial success. But before we get there, let me give you some practical advice. I think you need to learn how to save money first. I think you need to learn how to get to your first 10 grand by yourself. The younger you do it, the better off you will be. If you're watching this at age 47 and you're like, I've never saved 10 grand, start now. Hopefully you can do it before 50. If you're 12 years old and hearing this and you get your first 10 grand by 18, you are way ahead of a lot of other people. But the skill that you learn by saving money is delayed gratification. And that's the major skill that you need to learn right now. It'll apply to everything in your life. The major skill is delayed gratification. And I did not have that whatsoever. The reason I didn't have it was because I'm a salesman. I get instant gratification. And I can do it in minutes of you walking into my store, walking into my boutique, whatever it is. I can very quickly establish rapport, get you smiling, figure out how much money you got, and get you to the cash register. And it was instant gratification. I loved the thrill of the sale. And then when I became an attorney, the first case I ever took like 4 years and I lost it. But the first case I ever signed up took about 18 months. And the client was so happy. It was actually a pregnant woman. She had slipped and fallen outside of an IHOP because there was an oil spill from a local, you know, company. And it was a messy case, had a workers' comp element to it. But bottom line, I was like, look, I'm a brand new lawyer. I had just gotten licensed. I had just gotten sworn in as an attorney. They didn't even have my bar card yet. They gave me a bar number, but not a bar card. And that same day I went and signed up this case. It took me about 18 months and I settled it for $95,000. She was not expecting to get anywhere near that amount. It was a fantastic settlement for what she had gone through. And she was so happy that she sent me a $500 tip in the mail. She sent me a money order for $500 after I took my attorney's fees. So experiencing that delayed gratification, experiencing the moment that my dad became a citizen, I was able to take him and my mom on a first international vacation and seeing just how happy they were being in other countries and traveling the world. being able to take my wife and my parents to Mecca for pilgrimage right after I got married. Like those are things where you realize delayed gratification matters. And so if you're instant gratification all the time, there's nothing that you're working on in terms of the long term. Every single day will just be a rat race. And so if you're 100% of your time is just spent on short term goals, and sometimes this is just simply as going to the gym. I'm not talking about just money, like find something that's long term. Hey, I need to lose 20 pounds over the next year. So if I average a quarter of a pound every few days or a third of a, I can do that long term. So I think saving money is a skill that encapsulates delayed gratification, but also financial awareness. Because if your goal is to save 10 grand and then you find something that goes on sale, like these Bose headphones for $200, and you're like, oh man, I really want those headphones, but I'm in the process of saving money. And then you wait. And then 3 months later, you see them on clearance for $149. You're like, wow, I just saved $50 just because I waited a little bit and studied the market. And the longer you do that, the more you realize there's like cyclical trends in the markets, whether that's with real estate, whether that's with cars, whether that's with luxury items. And then you start thinking, okay, well, how can I get these things and make money while making these purchases? Like how can I drive a car for a year or two and make money on the transaction? How can I turn my living situation from paying $1,500 or $2,000 a month in rent to cash flowing $500 a month in rent, right? And you notice it's usually going to be the foreign kids in college that they put a house in their name or their parents put a house in their name, and then they're renting out three or four other rooms to their college students and colleagues. So those kinds of things start with having the ability to save money. And if it takes you 5 years to save your first batch, then do it. But also have a plan. Like, hey, once I get to 10 grand, here's what I'm going to do. And here's how I'm going to spend it. And here's how I'm going to invest it. And all that time, as you're focusing on that goal, your first idea of how you're going to spend it is going to change drastically from the time you actually have the money. And maybe by the time you get the money, you're like, no. I'm going to wait till I hit 25K because that's when I can make a real move. And plus, I'm fine. My lifestyle is fine. Teaches you delayed gratification, living below your means, and studying, being patient. That's where I would start.
Yeah, it's a level of discipline that most of us never really learn or master. And especially in a time where there is constant instant gratification, right? I remember as a kid watching Simpsons, right? I like the commercial break would come on and I'd like run and do everything that I could so that I could get back, because if I missed it, I missed it.
Yeah.
Now it's like Netflix and it's like, don't like it. Halfway through, click to the next one, scroll here, close
even
that.
Netflix asks you, are you still there? Like, they're so thoughtful. You know, you watch too much Netflix when you get that notification.
But, you know, we're at a time where children don't, you know, like don't know that. I remember we have a TV here. I didn't have a TV for about 8 years. It was a choice. No TV in the home. I didn't want my daughter exposed to media. She didn't have a tablet, cell phone, nothing like that. Still no tablet or cell phone. Because I really wanted to find a way to promote that delayed gratification, you know, and there's certain frameworks put in place, but generally speaking, I mean, I'm an adult and I even have to work hard to manage the way that I engage with social media, the time I spend and all of that. So with children, how do we teach them that if we don't even have that skill? I mean, it's a slippery slope, right?
Yeah. Look, my cousin has three boys and it's very admirable how he takes care of them, because when we went and visited, you know, it was time to eat. So they all went and washed their hands. They all sat down. They were all very clean. They finished their food. Once they finished, they took their plates to the kitchen. They're like, Bubba, can we have the iPad? He's like, okay, only 30 minutes. And then go, 30 minutes. They come back 29 minutes later and say, here's the iPad. And I'm like, what is that? How do you do that? He's like, a lot of discipline. And so getting them to a point where when you say something and they don't listen, the next time there has to be severe consequences. And doing that with multiple boys, I think is, you know, it's hard. Some of them are going to give you, it's going to be easier. Some aren't. And I'm not saying girls are easy. I don't have any girls yet, so I don't know. Sometimes maybe us, even as adults, we need that beat into us, you know? Like, hey, go to the gym, dude. Like, stop eating. Just put that cookie down. You don't need another crumble cookie. Just go to the gym and you'll be fine. You know, like, replace that thing with an apple. Like, go and put your phone down for 10 minutes and just play with your kid.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, yeah, it's my daughter brought home something yesterday. They're working on a project. What's one thing you'd love to have more of from your parents? And these kids created these long lists. And all she put there was more time playing with mom and dad.
Wow.
You know, and for me, that translates as quality time.
I'm constantly reminded by that all the time, especially like when my kid just looks up to me. Like, you know how sometimes they stare into your soul?
Yes.
And I'm like, man, this is cool, you know? And I just try to have as many moments of those as possible.
Ali, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to share your information, your socials, and everything in the show notes so people can find you and connect with you and learn from you. Thank you for what you're doing for the community. And I look forward to speaking with you soon.
Yeah, thank you for having me.